Back long about 1992 or 3, somewhere in there, I sat down with my maternal grandfather, Robert Johnson Whalen Jr., Bob, to his friends, and a tape recorder, and I got him to tell me his stories. Not all of them. I wish I'd gotten more, but the ones I got were pretty good. I recommend this, by the way, if you have older relatives, get their stories. They'll enjoy telling them, and you'll be glad you got them. But I asked him, in the course of this storytelling, about him and his wife, my grandmother Hazel. I asked, what was their story? And this is what he told me. I think your grandmother and I started going together when I was about a sophomore in high school. We went together until we got married. Of course, she had some other boyfriends right to begin with, but then she settled on me. That first year or so, it wasn't real thick. I wasn't the only fellow, and she wasn't the only girl. I don't know for sure what made me decide that she was the one I wanted to marry. She worked magic on me some which way. I don't know. That's pretty good. Now, missing information that kind of entertains me anyway is that my grandmother Hazel was 2 years older than my grandfather, a senior then to his sophomore. So maybe, yes, working some magic on him, I could see that. Now, my grandfather was born in 1916, so a little arithmetic lets you know that this would have had to have been long about 1932. So the Great Depression. Now, I don't know about you, but I had a little trouble picturing Depression-era dating in rural Texas, which is where they were in those days, Arcadia, Texas, down in Galveston County. So I asked my grandfather to tell me more. What did they do? How much did things cost? Where did he get the money? And this was what he said. I mowed yards. Every yard I mowed, I got 50 cents for. This was with one of those little Pennsylvania real-time push mowers. When you pushed it, the wheels turned the blade. A big yard, and I got 50 cents. And I'd spend every nickel of it that night on your grandma. We went to Alvin, went to the picture show, and came out, went to the drugstore. Each of us got a Coke or something to drink, and that 50 cents was gone. But I guess I did a pretty good job of court. Now, I love everything about that, especially because not only is it their story, but because of who they are to me, it is, in a sense, also my story. It's part of the story of how I came to be who I am. But I listen to that story, and even though it's only 89 years ago, not that long ago, comparatively speaking, but I listen to it, and I find myself catapulted into a whole different world, a strange world. I love it, but it's strange. I love that he said Pennsylvania real-type push mower. How many of you are like, oh, I've used one of those? There's a few of us. I love that you could go on a date for 50 cents. That's not even 50 cents each. That's 50 cents total. How many of you have ever been on a 50-cent date? I love that he says picture show. The picture show, not the movies, not a film, certainly not the cinema. They went to the picture show. And I love, love, love that he called it courting. Courting! And I love that he said she worked magic on me some which way, I don't know. Some of you are like, now that I have experienced. But still, such a different world, a different culture. And I find I have some trouble picturing it. How did they dress? Well, I have kind of a mental image of that, but it's fuzzy. How did they get to the picture show? I'm imagining a car, but am I right? What kind of car? How did they arrange their dates? They didn't have mobile phones. Speaking of which, no phone. Did their parents just worry about them till they got home, or what? And even just, what did they see at the picture show? I have trouble picturing that. I mean, research tells me that the number one box office hit in 1932 was something called The Kid from Spain. Eddie Cantor had top billing, but how many of you are like, oh yes, Eddie Cantor, old Banjo Eyes, I've seen all of his motion pictures, they're aces. You know, my grandmother actually had quite a large collection of records, the big 10-inch shellac records that ran at 78 RPM. And again, research tells me that in 1932, the number one song was a Cole Porter tune called Night and Day, recorded by Leo Reisman and his orchestra with voices by that new hot artist, Fred Astaire. That song was probably playing in the background on some of their dates. But anyone want to hum that tune for me? And it's not just the way they talk, the language they use, their pop culture that's different and strange. It goes right down to the way they thought. Just by way of trivial example, my grandparents in those days would not have thought of themselves as teenagers. Did you know that? Not that they weren't 16 and 18 respectively, they were, but the word teenager wasn't a part of the common parlance back then. Here's a nice Google engram of the word teenager, which first appeared in print in hyphenated form, teen-ager, in 1922. But you can see the word doesn't really start getting used until the mid-1950s. My grandparents would not have thought to themselves, we're teenagers. And I wonder how they would have thought of themselves. Things have changed so from then to now. The culture is different, the language is different, the worldview is different. Such that without a great deal of research and a great deal of care, even just across 89 years, we're almost certain to be picturing it wrong. I mean, not in broad outlines, but the details. Just 89 years, and so much has changed. And at that, it's still the English language and the American culture. So now multiply that by 35, and that's how long ago, roughly speaking, the story takes place that is our text this morning from the Book of Ruth, roughly 1140 BC-ish. And then, of course, we remember, we have to factor in that it's the Hebrew language and the culture of Bronze Age Palestine. And so as we enter the text, we need to tread carefully with humility about what we don't know and a willingness to investigate what we may not understand. We're in a different world. And I say that particularly because we're in Ruth chapter 3, where the ideas are particularly strange sounding, and the customs may seem particularly bizarre. Chapter 3 begins in medias res, in the middle of things. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Where are we? What's going on? This is now the third sermon in the sermon series we're working on, called Ruth, the Romance of Redemption. It's from the biblical book of Ruth, from the Old Testament, and it's complicated because the book of Ruth is one continuous, interconnected story. And so much has already happened by the time we get to chapter 3. So if you please, some previouslys. Previously, in the book of Ruth, we were introduced to Naomi and her daughter-in-law Ruth, who together form a sort of aggregate main character dyad for the story. What I mean is this. The story is, in one sense, the story of Ruth, a Moabite Gentile pagan, and how she came to find a home and be accepted into the people of God, such that ultimately she even becomes the ancestress of the great King David. But Ruth is a very static character. She has experiences, and her outward situation is radically transformed because of those experiences, but she comes into the story already very self-actualized and doesn't really have much of a character arc. Character-wise, the emotional center of the story is Naomi. In chapter 1, we meet the Israelite woman Naomi and watch as, in the first 4 verses of the story, everything she thought she had is taken away from her. her husband Elimelech dies, her sons die, she's reduced to poverty. Everything is gone except Ruth, her Gentile daughter-in-law, who in faithfulness chooses to cling to Naomi and to the God whom she has come to know through Naomi and her family. But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God." And if you want to know more about that, I encourage you to read Ruth chapter 1. You can go back and listen to that first sermon in this series. It's available as an MP3 on our website for streaming or download, or you can watch a video of it either on our Facebook page or on our YouTube channel. Just so many choices of how to access that sermon. So then here are Ruth and Naomi, just the two of them against the world. And what's Naomi's emotional weather? She's bitter. Desperately bitter over what has happened to her. "The Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty." She's mad at God. She's feeling helpless, like there's nothing to be done. So it falls to Ruth to figure out how they're going to live. How is she going to take care of herself and Naomi? Well, as we're told, it's the season of the barley harvest, and so Ruth goes out gleaning. Israelite law afforded to the poor in Israel the right to glean, which meant you're poor, you don't have any crops of your own, you are allowed to go into the fields of those who do have crops and gather up whatever is left behind from the harvest. It's a kind of a Bronze Age social safety net. And so Ruth goes out to glean. And that's Ruth's character. She will make the best of whatever situation she's in, and she will take whatever sliver of opportunity she's offered. And the story says, so she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. And we talked last week about how in a story like the book of Ruth, "she happened to come" is the functional equivalent of "God so ordained it that she came." The language there in Hebrew is the language used to describe the inevitable outworking of the plan of God. God is at work behind the scenes of the story. And by the way, if you want to hear that sermon, same deal, on the website for download or streaming, YouTube, Facebook, go find it. But when it says that Boaz is of the clan of Elimelech, that's Naomi's dead husband, remember. In other words, he's a relative. And Boaz, as we talked about last week, is sort of the romantic lead in the story. Now, it's a May-December romance. Boaz is much older than Ruth. And at this point in the story, they're just meeting. Romance hasn't blossomed yet. But Boaz is kind to Ruth. He's heard about her taking care of Naomi. He admires it. He says to her, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Which, by the way, I love that image of God as a mother bird protecting her chicks. God as a mother bird, by the way, is actually the first image of God in the Bible. The Spirit of God brooding over the egg, so to speak, of creation in Genesis 1. But at any rate, Boaz takes a special interest in Ruth. He invites her to eat with him. He instructs his workers to be good to her. And she comes home to Naomi with plenty and tells Naomi all about it. And we read, "Naomi also said to her, 'The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers.'" And I said last week that that word redeemer was going to be really, really important. And it is. It's kind of the beating heart of the book of Ruth, that word redeemer. And this is what I was talking about at the beginning of the sermon when I said we need to tread carefully with humility about what we don't know and a willingness to investigate what we may not understand, because we're in a different world here. Different customs, different thought patterns, different worldview. And the word that's translated here, redeemer, is a technical term, and it doesn't have a close English equivalent. So before we go any further today, we need to talk about this idea of the redeemer. I do hope you recall that we're reading something in English translation that was originally written in Hebrew. And in Hebrew, the word is goel. You all say that with me if you want. Goel. And it's an important word. You should know the word. Goel. And what it means to be a goel is to act out a set of responsibilities. So, for instance, if a person is murdered, we're going to start with murder and work our way back. If a person is murdered, the goel, who is the nearest male relative who is able-bodied enough to go to work, to go to take this up, the goel has the responsibility of hunting down the murderer and getting justice. He's a redeemer in that sense, in that he's redeeming, buying back the shed blood of the murderer by seeking to shed the blood of the murderer. This was part of the law. It was basically a way to avoid the escalation of a full-on blood feud. The goel is the designated person who seeks justice for the murder victim. And when the murderer has been slain, blood for blood, that puts an end to it. The goel had economic responsibilities as well. We remember, we talked about how in Israelite understanding, land didn't just belong to individuals, it belonged to the clan. And if an individual became so poor that he needed to sell off his land in order to live, it was the responsibility of the goel, the nearest male relative who was economically able to take it up, it was the responsibility of the goel to buy back the land so it didn't leave the clan. Similarly, the goel had what we might call familial responsibilities. If a man were to die, leaving no children, but if he were to leave behind a widow who was still of an age to have children, it was the responsibility of the goel to take the widow as his wife, even if he already has other wives, and then to try to give her a child who would be considered legally the heir of the deceased man. Now, that may sound weird to us and even kind of icky, maybe, because some of you may be thinking about a brother-in-law or a sister-in-law and going, ugh. But remember, different world, different worldview, different customs. We call it levirate marriage, and it was an important way for widows to be taken care of and inheritance not to be lost. Now, there were other minor additional duties that could fall to a goel. All of that is covered in Torah, the Old Testament law, particularly Leviticus 25, Numbers 35, Deuteronomy 25. If you want to go and read those could be your Christian homework, Leviticus 25, Numbers 35, Deuteronomy 25. But it enters into the story here, this business of the goel, because Boaz is, to Ruth and Naomi, because he's of the same clan as Elimelech, a goel, a redeemer. And now we're ready to hear the story. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you?" Basically, what Naomi has just said to her is, "Ruth, I have an idea." See, Naomi has been watching Ruth go out to glean in Boaz's field and come home and talk about Boaz. How kind he is, what nice thing he did that day. And this has been going on day after day for about 2 months. But now the barley harvest and the wheat harvest are over. No more gleaning in the fields. Hopefully, through Ruth's industry and Boaz's generosity, they've saved up enough to get them through to the next harvest. But Naomi says to Ruth, "You need a more permanent situation." When she says rest, by the way, that's a Hebrew idiom that means a good marriage. Naomi is about to act in the age-old tradition of the Satshanit, the Hebrew matchmaker. She continues, "Is not Boaz our relative, with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." Now, a quick word about that, because probably most of us haven't done a lot of threshing or winnowing. So in those days, you would harvest the stalks of grain with sickles, put them in sheaves to dry, and then put them on the threshing floor. Then you would drive heavy threshing sledges over the grain to break up the stalks and the husks. That's the threshing. When the threshing was done, you would use winnowing forks, which are like pitchforks, to toss the threshed grain into the air. You would do it in the evening when the stiff breeze of the evening was blowing. And the breeze would blow away the chaff, and the good grain would fall back to the threshing floor. So here it is, winnowing time. Boaz has his winnowing going on. And Naomi says, "Wash therefore and anoint yourself and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking." Always cracks me up just a little bit because Naomi is like, okay, you're going to romance a fellow, so be sure and bathe. Like, is Ruth in junior high? She needs that advice. But what Naomi is saying is, make yourself attractive. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, "All that you say, I will do." Now remember, customs. You have to understand, first of all, that it was during winnowing that the grain is most vulnerable to being stolen. So during winnowing, it was the custom to kind of make an outdoor party of things and camp out at the threshing floor to protect the grain against thieves and robbers. Naomi knows this, and she knows if Boaz is a conscientious man, he's not going to just send his guys to guard the grain. He's going to be camping out with them in solidarity with his workers. But now let's be honest. To us, this sounds pretty dicey, yes? It sounds, in fact, quite naughty. It sounds like Naomi is trying to pimp Ruth out, so to speak. Can I say pimp Ruth out in a sermon? I did. He will tell you what to do, and everyone goes, "I bet he will." And our 21st century Protestant, to be fair, Puritan sensibilities are a little offended by this. They're going to be lying down together on the threshing floor. There might be threshing on the floor. Is that what they're calling it these days? I hope Ruth is wearing her purity ring. And there is a worldview and customs in play that we don't understand at first. And yes, this, legitimately speaking, could be trouble. It absolutely could. Naomi is counting on the character of Ruth and the character of Boaz to make this turn out right. But I love this. Because what it is Naomi having hope. Naomi has rediscovered hope. And that's, by the way, what you have to get over bitterness. See, when you have hope, you're not helpless. When you have hope, you make a plan. And Naomi has hope, and so she's making a plan. Now, again, as I did last week, I'm going to try to let the story speak for itself as much as possible, because it's quite a lovely thing without my interruptions. So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. Then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay there. At midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. He said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And by the way, I personally always hear her saying that in like a sweet, sleepy voice. But now, what's happening here? Is Ruth trying, as my grandfather would say, to work her magic on him some which away? Well, I wouldn't say magic exactly, but it is, we might say, ceremonial. And that's the thing you have to understand. There is a ceremonial aspect to this that we'll miss if we haven't done the research. See, first of all, Ruth lays at his feet, which is a symbolic gesture of humility. And she calls herself your servant. And what she's doing is paradoxically both very humble and very bold. On the one hand, she is throwing herself on Boaz's mercy. She is appealing to him as one who is herself helpless, which she is. But at the same time, though, she is, as it were, asking for what she can expect as her right due to the nature of the Goel relationship. She's laying claim to him. And you have to hear that there are religious overtones to what she's saying. She's making an implicit connection to what Boaz had said to her previously. You may remember, Boaz had said to her, "The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." You remember that? Here she says, "Spread your wings over your servant." In other words, she's asking Boaz to act as the living embodiment of God's grace and provision for her. She's saying to Boaz, "You said those words about taking refuge under the wings of the God of Israel. Well, you can be the one who can make that happen for me." And what she's doing is, without saying so many words, is she's asking him to marry her. I love this because it is the single most romantic moment in the whole Bible, and it's the woman proposing to the man. It's a bit feminist. But again, there's a custom that if we don't know it, we'll miss, because that word wings is also what they call the folds of a person's cloak. When she says, "Spread your wings over me," she's saying, "Spread your cloak over me." And for this next bit, by the way, we're indebted to ethnographic research that was done back in the early 1900s when ancient customs were still practiced among the nomadic tribes of that part of the world. And what we learn, if we do the research, is that in general, a man putting his garment over the widow of a dead near relative was a way of claiming her for marriage. Interestingly, what it said was that it was, in a sense, a continuation of the previous marriage. In fact, if he did this for her in a timely fashion, he didn't even have to pay any bride price for her. Now, beyond what Ruth is doing here, there's what God is doing here. I love the fact that all of this is taking place on a threshing floor. A threshing floor. Some of you are like, "Well, so?" But see, there's enormous symbolism in that. In the Bible, threshing and winnowing are symbolic of being tested. Boaz and Ruth are being tested. Boaz is being tested because, will he do the right thing? If he were a different man, a more judgmental man, he might chase her away as trying to seduce him. If he were a different man, a less morally upright man, he might try to take advantage of her in this very compromising position. Ruth is being tested, though, too. Because what's Ruth like? Well, she's someone who is always taking care of business herself. And now the question is, can she let someone else be the one who takes care of business? Can she, in humility and confidence, trust to her Redeemer to let him handle things? Speaking of which, by the way, just on a comedy level, there's a flavor here of Ruth saying to Boaz, "Look, we're neither of us getting any younger here. You can't just keep a girl waiting forever. What's taking you so long? And we get an explanation of sorts in the next bit. And he said, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, and that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. What he's saying here is, sorry, I didn't dare dream that you would be interested in me. He's apparently been interested in her, but Boaz, being a decent man, wasn't going to push the power disparity between them. He's old, she's young. He's rich, she's poor. He's an Israelite, well-established, well-respected in the community. She's a Gentile foreigner. He has all the power, and she has none. Boaz says then that Ruth is being kinder to him even than she had been to Naomi, which is debatable but cute. He's also of the opinion that if she had wanted to, she could have married a man just as rich but a lot younger. Also debatable but cute. But what he's saying to her is, there are lots of men you could have had. If you wanted to marry rich, you could almost certainly have found yourself a young rich man. If you didn't care about riches, you could definitely marry for love to a poor young man. But the fact that Boaz understands exactly what Ruth is saying is manifest from what he says next. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. Now, when he says, I will do all for you that you ask, has she asked anything other than spread your wings over me? But he knows what she means. He knows that what she means is, would you just marry me already? And he says to her, and now it is true that I am a redeemer, yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Now, I should say here that the mystical types really like that verse, because when it says there is a redeemer nearer than I, they hear this as one of those places that appear occasionally in the Bible where a character accidentally says something truer than he or she realizes. So the mystics read that and they say, ah, yes, there is a redeemer nearer than Boaz to Ruth and Naomi, because he's a redeemer who is nearer to all of us, and it's Jesus. And I get that. I get that. It's kind of irresistible once you see it. It's in fact what's behind the wording of that song that we sang for the first time last week, There is a Redeemer. But on a non-mystical level, what Boaz is talking about is that there is a Goel in their clan who is more closely related to Elimelech than he is, and so they have to consult with that guy first. This is that, in a romance movie, this is the wrinkle, right? Because it's like the couple, boy meets girl, and then there's boy loses girl, like there's a threat to the romance. Well, this is it. There's a redeemer nearer. Now that Boaz knows Ruth is interested in him, and he is as he is in her, he's going to handle it. Remain tonight, he says, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then, as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. In other words, he's saying to his people, yes, but don't gossip, okay? Boaz has to formulate a plan to deal with the situation that there's actually a closer redeemer, and he needs his people not to ruin it with loose lips. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. So she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her when she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And you have to understand what this means, too. This is essentially bride price, which, remember, because he's a near relative and he has spread her cloak over her, he doesn't actually owe a bride price. But he's sending it to Naomi anyway, as a way of marking his seriousness, not only to Ruth, but to Naomi. Which kind of of lets me know that Boaz knows who put Ruth up to this. And she replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." And now I want us to go back to those lovely midnight words of Ruth. And again today, we have some small gifts we want you to take home with you. We have these little cards, little stands that are there in the back, two varieties of little stand that you can pick from. And what we want to invite you to do again is to take one per household, or at most two. We don't have an infinite supply. But what we'd like to invite you to do is to take these cards home with you, put them somewhere where you can see them so that you can meditate on them during the week. Also, by the way, if you're watching online and you live locally, you can contact me, make arrangements to stop by the church building during the week, and pick one up if you like. But what we'd like to urge you to do is, if you take one of these cards and set it up, take a picture of it and post it to your social media, if you use social media, to your Facebook or your Instagram or whatever you have. If you don't use social media, but you text, take a picture of it and text it to some of your friends. Just say, "Hey, this is what our church is doing, and we'd like you to use the hashtag Second Take with a 2, Second Take." Please do that to kind of get the word out that that's what we're doing here at Second Christian Church. We're going to be giving you one of these cards again next week, and our hope is that you'll maybe even try to memorize the verse in question. You'll have it all week. You put it where you can see it. Maybe you'll be able to memorize it. Right now, what I'd like you to do is sort of a down payment on that, is I'd like you to say the words along with me. "And she answered, 'I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer.'" And I hope you'll learn to make that prayer. I love this story so much, because even though it's Ruth's story, it's also my story. It's also your story, if you want it to be. Because the truth is, the mystics are right about this, at least. There is a Redeemer. A Redeemer closer than anybody. And he's for you. And you can place yourself at his feet today. He loves you with a passionate love. He won't force himself on you. But he loves you so much, it will just happen. It's so easy sometimes, I think, for us to forget that our Redeemer Jesus can be approached with that same humble, confident trust that Ruth showed. And I just want you to think on that for a moment. What difference might it make in your prayers and in your life if we just remembered to place ourselves at the feet of our Redeemer? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for the story of Ruth, for her beautiful example of humble, confident trust. Father, help us to trust our Redeemer in the same way. Father, help us to quit trying to be the one who takes care of business for ourselves, and to let our Redeemer handle what needs to be done. Thank you for Jesus, in whose name we pray. Amen. Would you stand, please? We're going to sing this song of invitation. It's the song that we learned last week, and I hope that you'll sing it again this week. Maybe you've never availed yourself of the Redeemer who's available to you today. That's something that you know you need to do. We'd like to encourage you to do that. Maybe you're looking for a church home, you found one here, and you want to let us know. We'd love to hear that from you as well. Just find me after church is over and talk to me. Maybe just right where you are, there's some way that in your life you've been trying to be in control of things, and you just need to come to the feet of the Redeemer. Let him handle it. Whether it's a decision that you need to let someone know about, or a decision you can make right where you are, just make those choices. Paul, Mark, of course, wants you to say with card.